Hello, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the H.P. Lovecraft Literary Podcast. I'm Chad Pfeiffer.
And I'm Chris Lackey. We're here on Patreon, and this is the bonus content for the month of December.
As you all well know, it is ghoul time.
Ghoul time.
We've been doing ghostly Christmas stories all month, and so for this show, just as we did for Halloween in October, we thought we'd talk a little bit about the origins of the holiday.
Mostly about how a lot of the things we do on Christmas have little to do with Christ, but are just holdovers from older pagan celebrations.
And we have a guest!
To talk with us about this wonderful pagan world of Christmas is Paula Dempsey!
Hello!
Hello, Paula. Thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thank you.
Paula is a published author and expert about all things mystical and creepy.
Just as you are, Chris. You two are both experts about this kind of thing, so I figured I'd just throw it out to you first. Where's a good place to start when we're talking the pagan origins of Christmas?
Well, since we're talking about Ghoultide, I think it's important that we jump into Yuletide, or Yule, the German/Nordic tradition. Yuletide is from December 21st until January 1st, at least it is this year. There is some connection to the Wild Hunt and Odin and a bunch of other stuff.
Yeah, the Wild Hunt actually is Anglo-Saxon Nordic. Mm-hmm. In the UK, at least, it doesn't always happen at Yule. It can happen at other times as well.
Oh.
Depending on who you believe and where the legend is, probably the most famous Wild Hunt is the one in Windsor Great Park, which is tied up with the story of Herne the Hunter, who leads the Wild Hunt. But it's likely that even that is a survival of an earlier story about Odin. The Wild Hunt materializes at different times of the year, not just Yule, and in different places. And there's usually a different origin story for each one.
Mm-hmm.
But what actually happens is the same. There's a kind of thundering noise. Sometimes they run on the ground, sometimes they're in the sky. In some versions of the story, it's not just hunters and horses, but there are really peculiar hounds, and they're white hounds with red ears. And they are peculiar to the Wild Hunt.
Now, I've heard that this also includes not only other hunters, but maybe some elves in some stories, spirits of the dead in other stories. There seems to be a lot of variation on what exactly is involved in the Wild Hunt.
It sounds a little like a prototypical Santa Claus in a way, right? Because this is a hunt that's happening in the sky, and Odin's leading these hunters through the sky, right? And there's these animals that you're talking about that sound a little like reindeer to me.
Well, the thing is, Odin, you know, is supposed to have a long white beard.
Mm-hmm.
And in the legends, he supposedly wore blue.
Right.
He had his eight-legged horse, Sleipnir, and he would come and visit people and bring gifts during Yule or bestow blessings. Children would fill their boots with hay for Sleipnir, while Odin would come down the fire holes or chimneys and lay gifts in socks. So eventually a lot of these things were tacked on to St. Nicholas, the patron saint of children.
Mm-hmm.
He kind of got swapped into the role, especially when Christianity took over.
Mm.
The Dutch call St. Nicholas Sinterklaas, which is St. Nicholas, Nicklaus in Dutch. So St. Nick, Sinterklaas, Santa Claus.
So these are all old German Nordic traditions. We're talking like old, right? Prehistoric almost? Or when do these start to get recorded?
The thing about Yule traditions and Christmas traditions is they're a kind of weird synthesis.
Sure.
When Christianity came, it kind of took over,
mm-hmm.
and people were just very reluctant to let go. So you get these really strange, supposedly Christian, even happening in churches, things.
Mm-hmm.
that are massively pre-Christian.
Right.
And they've been kind of co-opted, I think partly to keep people on side, because people didn't want to give this stuff up.
No way.
When they converted to the new religion.
It was fun. Mm. People loved doing these holiday traditions, as we do to this day. Why give that up? And if you want to be a salesman to your religion, you're like, oh no, we can keep all this wintertime festival
stuff. We can keep
stuff.
The good stuff.
Yeah.
It's just Jesus's birthday now.
Well, also during the solstice time, the Romans celebrated Saturnalia.
They did.
Which is yet another feast, party, holiday.
Yep.
And from my understanding, a lot of the origins of this holiday are quite a bit more debauched. So even though we've swapped in some Christian mythology to overlay, it did still temper the holiday a bit, where I think now the emphasis is on giving and community. And whereas my understanding is that in the darker ages, it was a lot more about partying against the night, kind of, right?
Yeah.
I think in pretty much every faith system, you will find something about light in the darker part of the year. I mean, we've just had Diwali.
Mm-hmm.
There's just something about the winter that makes people want to celebrate. So, I mean, people call Christ the light of the world. You know, it's something about going out and bringing light in.
Well, part of the Saturnalia tradition also, or some Romans worshipped Mithras as well, and Mithras was born during the solstice from a rock, and of course the shepherds came to check him out after he was born, and it sounds a little like Christianity, because of course we don't really know when Jesus was actually born. Kind of in the Bible they said the shepherds were out with their flocks at night, and that's something they did in the summer, not in the winter, so it just seems like since people were already celebrating Mithras and going, you know, why not, let's swap out this Mithras guy for Jesus. He's way better. And then people were like, do we still get to party? And they're like, oh yeah. And it was like, okay, fine.
Mithras, only men were allowed to party.
At one
point, it was kind of a bit touch and go whether Mithraism or Christianity would be the one that took off.
Oh, right.
They've got massive amounts of crossover between the two. Like you say, being the whole birth story actually is quite similar.
Mm-hmm.
Virgins are mentioned. A lot of it was taken from Zoroastrianism anyway. It all kind of has the same root.
Why do only the men get to party?
Mithraism was very much a warrior cult. So it was a Roman soldiers particularly, and it was exclusively for men.
Party sounds really lame.
They were thoroughly unpleasant individuals.
Well, there's a few other traditions that are celebrated around the UK specifically, and I think Paula knows a lot about that stuff.
Shall I tell you some animal stories?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I really love this because I actually saw one of these last year and it was amazing. Things called hodning or hudning are Christmas balls. Can I also throw in a quote from 1,000 years ago?
Yeah, go for it.
This is from the Penitential of Pseudo Theodore, which is like a great name. If anyone at the calends of January goes about as a stag or a bull, that is, making himself into a wild animal and putting on the heads of beasts, those who in such wise transform themselves into the appearance of a wild animal, penance for 3 years, because this is devilish.
Ooh.
This is a pan-European tradition of dressing as animals, usually in animal skins, with a head, a mask of some sort, at significant times of the year, particularly around Yule, the 12 days of Christmas. In some places, it's done on May Day or at Midsummer. Quite commonly, with the horse version, it's an actual horse skull, sometimes painted, with either a horse skin or some sort of drapery. In parts of the southwest, for example Wiltshire and Dorset, it's the same but with a bull. Now if you want to be super creepy, you put a candle inside the skull and then you go knock on people's doors after dark.
I do want to be super creepy. That sounds great.
Is this a Welsh tradition as well? I seem to remember us talking about that, I think, on our comment show. Somebody mentioned that there's this where you bury a skull of a horse and then you dig it up right around Christmas time, and then people go around to houses kind of mumming.
You have to forgive me because my Welsh is non-existent, so I may be pronouncing this wrong. But it's called the Marilwyd. It's a hodning tradition, but it's the Welsh version.
Mm-hmm.
We kind of have two things mixed up there because they certainly use a horse skull. The weird thing is that the jaw is always jointed. When you knock on the door and the people come to the door, you kind of rattle it, make it really menacing.
Yeah.
The thing is with these, they go back so far. I mean, this is obviously pre-Christian, that nobody's quite sure why they do it. And a very common answer to why do you do this custom is we have always done this. It may be that it brings luck to the house. It may be that it frightens away devils.
Mm-hmm.
From a practical point of view, it is usual to reward the geysers and their horse with beer and food.
Right.
So there's a kind of practical element to it as well.
That's why I do anything that I do, really.
Beer and food.
The Christmas tree has pagan origins. It was the evergreen. It would last through the dark winter time, and it was a symbol of hope and renewal. The Christians were like, okay, that's cool. You can keep that Christmas tree, but let's put some apples on it to represent the Garden of Eden. But those apples over time turned into Christmas ornaments. And holly, now it's supposed to be represent Christ's blood from his crown of thorns.
Christmas trees were very much a Germanic thing.
Right.
The story is that Prince Albert brought them to England. That is rubbish. They were already... They were already being used by German merchants and because of the trade routes. But Albert and Victoria certainly popularized them. Before that, we had kissing bows. And we now don't have kissing bows anymore. They've been pushed away by the Christmas tree. And that was a sort of double hoop of wood, like a wheel, covered in greenery, with your mistletoe and your holly and you hung that from the ceiling. And that was what we had before Christmas trees.
So was it hung horizontally or vertically?
No, you hung it horizontally.
Okay.
And that's where kissing under the mistletoe started.
Oh.
I'm going to talk a bit about wassailing and a little bit about what you should do with a cow and a cake.
Please.
Wassailing is actually an Anglo-Saxon term, oh. And it's derived from was hail, good health, or be of good health, be whole. In winter, when it's cold and miserable, and you get your bowl and you fill it full of wine or cider, often as usual, and you pass it around, and as you give your friends a drink, you say, was hail, good health. But then it started getting a bit weirder, because that kind of makes sense.
Sure.
But then people said, well, let's go out and was hail stuff. It's a custom that's come back. In the southwest, where they grow a lot of cider apples, you go out around Christmas time, you sprinkle some cider on the trees, which is a criminal waste, but there you go, and you wassail your trees. So you're going out, you're giving something back in the hope of a good crop of apples to make good cider next autumn.
All right.
So that is a really well-known one.
But people still do.
People still do. I think it's so much of British custom of Victorian revivals, but people certainly still do that. You have a king of the wassailer who looks after the bowl for the whole year.
Uh-huh.
Again, there's a thing about you take your wassail bowl around the houses, everybody has a drink, you have a bit of a party,
yeah.
There's some carols.
Yeah.
So many of these customs actually end up with just visiting your neighbours, eating their stuff, and then moving on. That's very common.
Well, I'd like to start talking about the Austrian or Bavarian tradition of Krampusnacht. Which happens on the 5th of December. It's the night before the Feast of St. Nicholas, and this happens mostly in Austria and parts of Bavaria and Eastern Europe. Now, Krampus is this half-goat, half-demon from this pre-Christian Alpine area where Santa gives good gifts. Krampus takes naughty kids, and he beats them with a birch stick, and then he sticks them in a sack to take them to hell, as you do. The celebration, on the 5th, men get dressed up as Krampus. There's some very elaborate Krampus outfits. Mm. They just run around with their birch sticks, try and hit kids, and get real drunk while they're doing this. And it's something that's been going on for a very long time, and it seems to be getting more well-known throughout the world just because it's so bizarre. Because Krampus is half-goat, half-demon.
Yeah.
Not half-goat, half-man. Half goat, half demon.
Yeah, Krampus awareness is higher than it's ever been. And most people know what that is now. And in fact, there was that horror movie, Krampus, which I don't know what kind of box office it did. I wish it had done better because I was really hoping they'd make a sequel called Krampus on Campus. It was like, the exact reaction I want to get.
There's definite parallels between him and the people dressing up as animals.
Yes.
Which, as I said, is a pan-Europe thing.
Right, yeah.
The fact that he's half goat is no surprise. I think there's a sense of it. You get it at Halloween as well.
Mm-hmm.
There's a kind of liminal space around significant holidays. It feels like these people are kind of using that to step outside of the normal.
Yeah.
You know, dress as animals. An awful lot of them seem to be about frightening people. I mean, the horses we talked about earlier.
Yeah.
You rattle your teeth and frighten people. And I'm not quite sure why you have to be scary. That there are some suggestions that it might be to actually scare the devil away or to scare away bad spirits.
As a person who used to work in a haunted house, I know that there is power in being able to scare people, and that if it's permitted to be able to do so, that's even more emboldening. I think that is something that people in general like. Having these holidays gives people permission to be able to be naughty. That is a way for people to blow off steam and feel free and also step out of their normal lives. Like you were saying, it's almost like a supernatural experience because you become this other thing.
Weirdly, they tend to be more full-on in countries that are quite religious.
Yeah.
So it's like every so often, as you say, you just got to cut loose. But it's regulated.
I think even down to people now, it's a big trend to wear hideous Christmas sweaters. It is participating in something like that, though, because you're saying, I would never dress like this, but it's the holiday season, so let's put on something really stupid.
Yeah.
And it's a very thinned down version of, dressing like a half goat, half raccoon or whatever.
Very thinned down.
But it's still part of being that, being part of the holiday in a way where you change your own representation even.
Yeah.
You've obviously seen my Christmas jersey. It had a raccoon on it.
Well, there you go.
Perfect.
Now, there's another associate of Santa Claus in Europe called Black Peter or Sooty Peter. He's a companion of St. Nicholas and is supposed to be a Moor from Spain. Of course, Dutch people do him in blackface, which is really inappropriate now. And there's been a lot of backlash over the last few years about the tradition of doing this. Before St. Nick's feast, Santa and Sooty Peter show up on a boat, which they have come from Madrid, specifically Madrid. St. Nicholas is actually supposed to be from Turkey. So I'm actually confused by all of this. Like, why... There's talk that this might actually be a holdover from Odin and the Wild Hunt, because he used his black crows as helpers that would they would go to the chimneys and listen to see if children had been good or bad. Or another suggestion is that this is a holdover from legends where St. Nicholas enslaved the devil and had him do tasks. So that's kind of also a crossover with Krampus as well. So Krampus might have been enslaved at one point. Sooty Peter might have been the devil at one point, but they've kind of softened him into being an assistant to Santa Claus as well. And the elves, and going back to the Wild Hunt, one of the versions of the Wild Hunt, he has a bunch of elves and fairies with him when he's on this traipse through the woods. Those are his assistants. So that's kind of where the idea of elves and Santa Claus come together. Again, supposedly, because everything is so mishmashed, all these different people moving to different areas with their older traditions and people just changing their traditions willy-nilly because they don't like them anymore. They want something different. It's so very hard to trace all this stuff.
It is interesting to sort of track myths and legends around and see how they mutate, but some of it just goes back so far that you can't get a definite historical fix on it.
But
the thing is with folklore, it is not fixed. It will always mutate.
Yeah.
If you look at something like pantomime, which has been with us for about 300 years now, it is traditional to put in contemporary jokes. I was at a pantomime on Saturday. We got Brexit gags. You know, you always do it. That is part of it, that it has to be given a topical edge.
That giving it the topical edge, I think, is something that could easily change the tradition of it. Whereas, like, you do something that's topical once and it's a hit. And they do it again next year because it was really funny or people really liked it, and they do it again and they do it again, and eventually they forget why it was originally done. It just becomes part of the tradition.
Why do you do it? Because we always have.
That's it. Yeah, exactly.
On our first episode of this month, Ken touched on the fact that Christmas, while we have Christianized it, also is participated in because it's a secular holiday at the same time. A lot of these traditions are pagan and have nothing to do with the Christian religion, and that's a gift to people in a way, because there have been so many arguments about religion. And obviously, I think in you know, when the Puritans came over to America, they weren't celebrating this because that was outside of what they thought they should be doing. But for the British middle class, when Christmas became a popular holiday again, part of that gift was that nobody had to argue about religion. It was just a thing that everybody did.
Yeah, I think the secular aspects of Christmas are awesome, and that's what I primarily celebrate because it's something I'm familiar with. But there's some stuff that I am not familiar with that I find extremely fascinating. This one I just discovered recently. It's a Greek one and also celebrated in Eastern Europe. I mean, celebrate's not really the right word. But on Christmas, goblins would come out of the ground and cause mischief until the 6th. I stole this directly from Wikipedia just because I can't make it any more brief than what it says right here. But it says, many Greeks have imagined them as tall, black, and hairy with burning red eyes, goats or donkey's ears, monkey's arms, tongues that hang out, and heads that are huge. Nevertheless, the most common belief is that they're small black creatures, humanoid apart from their long black tails and said to resemble little black devils. They are also mostly blind, speak with a lisp, and love to eat frogs, worms, and other small creatures.
They sound great. There is a kind of English equivalent. If you don't take your Christmas decorations down by Twelfth Night, the berries, the holly and mistletoe berries, will turn into goblins and smash up your house.
Oh, nice.
Wow.
So you should never, ever leave it. I never, ever. Occasionally it's 2 minutes to midnight, but they always come down on Twelfth Night because we do not want that to happen.
And you've never been attacked by goblins?
I have never been attacked by goblins, so it must work.
Proof is in the pudding. Yep. They're called Kalikenzori, these Greek little goblins. To protect yourselves from them, you would leave a colander on your doorstep. They would be compelled to count the holes in the colander. But the thing is, three is supposedly a holy number. When they count, it would go 1, 2, 3. And when they would say three, they would cause themselves to explode.
Such a good story. I haven't heard that one.
If you were born on the 12 days of Christmas, there was a chance that you would turn into one of these goblins. And to prevent this transformation,
oh no,
you were supposed to bind the baby in tresses of garlic or straw and singe the child's toenails to stop this from happening. According to another legend, anyone born on Saturday could see and talk with these green goblins.
That is a great legend.
There's a lot of creatures around this holiday, you know? There's a lot of little varmints and half man, half animal things. A lot more than any other holiday.
Yeah. We have the sort of horse thing sometimes at midsummer as well, or at Halloween.
Yeah.
If you kind of look at the pattern of folk customs, you get to Easter or Christmas and it's just like loads. And then the rest are sort of scattered throughout the year.
Hey, Paula, do you have any info on divination practices around the holiday season?
The first thing is the Yule candle. It was used to be used a lot in the UK, but also in Scandinavia. So although there's not necessarily any evidence that it came over with the Anglo-Saxons or Vikings, probably did, particularly given the Yule.
Mm-hmm.
So you lit this on Christmas Eve. It was supposed to burn through to early Christmas morning. And then quite often you would relight it every night until Twelfth Night. But as long as it burnt steadily, mm-hmm. it blessed your household. It brought good luck. If it flickered, and particularly if it died, it was likely that there would be a death in the household within the year.
Oh, no.
Oh, wow.
So it was also a form of divination. And you never blew out a Yule candle. To blow on the Yule candle was to bring the bad luck yourself.
Ah.
In Denmark, they kept them for a whole year as a charm against evil and would light them during a thunderstorm to stop the house being struck by lightning.
Now, the Yule log, that's a very popular phrase that's thrown around. From what I've read, it's basically they would get a huge log and then burn it over a period of days. Is that correct?
You get a very big log. It has to burn for at least 12 hours, and some divination stuff associated with this as well.
Right.
You had to stop the flames going out early.
Well, something I heard was that the sparks from the Yule log would indicate the birth of animals in the coming year. If like a spark or a ember came off of the Yule log, it would represent that for every one of those, a sheep would be born or cow or something like that.
That one I haven't heard of, but I wouldn't be surprised. There's certainly a big link between the Yule log and fertility.
Oh.
It was quite common to spread the ashes on the fields, for example, to make the fields fertile the next year. In parts of Cornwall, they sometimes scratch the figure of a man on the Yule log before they put it on the fire.
What is that supposed to represent?
Well, nobody knows. I mean, it could be a residual, if you wanted to be very macabre about it, it could be a residual human sacrifice thing.
Oh, right, yeah.
Might just be, you know, fun to do. In Yugoslavia, they dressed it up with flowers and things.
Now, you guys are talking about Yule logs. I would like to know a little more about the Yule lads.
Oh,
and also,
God.
There's an early Bjork song that's about the Yule cat. It's in her native language, so I have no idea what she's talking about. If you could explain that to me, that'd be great as well.
Well, first of all, the Yule cat is a giant man-eating cat that prowls the countryside around Christmas time.
Mm-hmm.
And if you happen to be wearing clothes that you got for Christmas, you won't be eaten.
So if you're wearing your regular old clothes, the cat's going to eat you.
The cat will kill you and eat you. But if you're wearing new clothes that you got as a gift around the solstice, then you will be spared by the Yule cat. The message is basically make sure your loved ones have new warm sweaters and the Yule cat will not eat them.
That's got to be something that, you know, the clothing industry in Iceland promoted this, right? I mean, that has to be a lobbyist creation of some kind.
Could be, yeah.
There's a New Year's custom that you should always have new clothes when the clock strikes midnight for New Year. If you do, you get good luck for the year.
But now the Yule lad, I freaking love the Yule lads. They are these 13 trolls, but they've kind of changed over the years and they've become more kind of like gnomes, closer to Santa. Like they have red hats and white beards.
Where's the, I mean, what country?
This is Iceland, again. This is another Iceland tradition where the 13 of them would start coming one per day. The first one on the 12th of December, the day that we're actually recording this episode.
Yeah.
And then one would keep coming until Christmas Eve. And then they would leave one by one after that. And they've got these crazy names like Spoon Licker and Sheep Botherer. Like, they're just crazy. And
your old nickname.
Yeah. They're super fascinating. On Facebook and Twitter, I'm going to post the whole You Lads as they come up each day. But how it's actually celebrated there is each day children get a little present, but if they're bad, they get a potato instead. Hmm. The You Lads are actually the sons of evil trolls, Gryla and her husband Lepalui. Now, Gryla is kind of like the Krampus of Iceland, where she goes out and she gets children that have been misbehaving, and her husband, this other troll, he is kind of just really her assistant. He carries her bag. She grabs the kids, puts them in the bag, and then takes them to her cave to eat them, because that's what you do.
Yeah.
It is so bizarre, yet kind of familiar in a way.
Sure, and I love potatoes, so it'd be a win-win for me if that's still tradition.
Isn't it funny how so many of these customs, it's not like if you're naughty, you don't get a present. You actually get something nasty.
Right.
Yeah, because Black Peter, if you're not good, he puts coal in your shoes.
Yes. Now, if you're poor, you know, actually, that was funny that you say that, because there's Befana, who is the Italian Christmas witch. Mm. She flies around on a broomstick and she gives presents and stuff like that.
Love it.
She shows up before the Epiphany on January 5th. Mm. Now, she's rides a broomstick, has a black shawl that's covered in soot from chimneys. The thing with her is if you were bad, you would get coal in your shoe. But if you were poor and bad, you just got a stick, because I guess coal is actually kind of valuable. And poor kids couldn't even get a lump of coal. They just got a stick.
I suppose it's because we're functioning at the end of the year and we have to do some kind of inventory and review of how we've been over the prior year in order to move on to the next year with kind of a clean slate or a clean conscience. Mm-hmm. I mean, even Festivus has the airing of the grievances, right? So I think that there is an essential part of punishment that is part of this holiday that comes from, you know, just kind of taking stock of what you've been like for the last year.
Yeah.
Now, there's one last tradition that I want to talk about here, because it is actually an American tradition that is claiming it wasn't, is the Christmas pickle.
I have never heard of the Christmas pickle.
No, and I haven't either. I've eaten pickles around Christmas.
Well, this is popped up in the turn of the last century, so the end of the 19th century into the 20th century. Supposedly, it came from German immigrants.
Okay.
And it is a decoration made to look like a pickle, like a glass pickle that's hidden in the Christmas tree. And if you spot it, you get some candy. There's this place in Michigan, Berrien Springs, which is known as the Christmas pickle capital of the world. But the thing is, in Germany, nobody knows what the hell a Christmas pickle is.
Yeah.
So this whole idea that it's from immigrants is totally fabricated. Doing some research. Now, again, I'm stealing from Wikipedia here because it seems to be the most concise explanation for this whole thing.
Mm.
It says that this Christmas pickle coincides in the 1890s with the importation of glass Christmas tree decorations from Germany. And Woolworths was the first company to import these types of decorations, and they had glass vegetables that were imported from France. Woolworths was selling these glass pickles as Christmas ornaments for some reason, mm-hmm. and they somehow became popular with a group of people, maybe German immigrants in the United States. Nobody's really sure. In parts of mostly the Midwest, kind of around Michigan,
right,
parts of Illinois, Wisconsin, Ohio, that area. And there's all these crazy stories about how there was this Christmas pickle originated from the American Civil War, where this Bavarian guy was in jail and he was starving and some dude gave him a pickle and it saved his life. And then there's another one where St. Nicholas saved two Spanish children that were trapped in a barrel of pickles by an evil innkeeper.
Okay. Well, that all sounds like they're sort of, you know, trying to come up with stories to support a tradition that really is just about a game, right? Because isn't it you have to spot the pickle in the tree?
Yeah.
And then you get a present. I feel like around Christmas, we still carry on with having celebrations and the whole season is a game. So I think about Elf on the Shelf. Isn't that the same kind of thing?
Yeah.
Have you heard, again, I apologize for my pronunciation, of the Kagana?
No.
In parts of Spain and Italy and France, they have a small china figure that's hidden in the nativity scene. So you have to look for him.
Uh-huh.
So you do your crib and you put him. And it's a little boy with his trousers down. And there's a polite way of saying this. He is having a poo.
Okay.
This is a certainly 200 to 300-year-old tradition.
Wow.
Having a little boy in at the back of your nativity scene doing that.
That reminds me of actually when I was a kid, my mother would always put up this nativity scene in her living room. And I would go and steal the baby Jesus and replace it with my little Yoda action figure. And I did it every year that it became a, how long is it going to take before mom realizes that Yoda's in the nativity scene again? It's like a game that we would play. So
Christmas traditions, both new and old, are bountiful. Right. There's so many of them and so many cultures and traditions that it's hard to keep track of. But I think that is probably where we should round it up. We've been talking for quite some time now. So,
well, thank you so much for coming on the show and sharing your knowledge and passion and experience with us.
Thank you for inviting me, and have a happy Yule.
You as well.
Have a very merry solstice.
Bye-bye.
Thanks, everybody. That's all we have for this week.
On the H.P. Lovecraft Literary Podcast on Patreon.
Bye-bye.
HPPodcraft.com